Part 2. The Making of the Stone. Up from Earth's center, through the seventh gate, I rose, and on the throne of Saturn sate, and many a knot unraveled by the road, but not the master knot of human fate. There was the door to which I found no key. There was the veil through which I might not see. Some little talk awhile of me and thee there was, and then no more of thee and me. The Rubaiyat of Omar Khayyam. A serious difficulty which confronted the apprentice to alchemy at the outset was that he did not know what raw material to work on. Many of the masters of the art would only say that the subject of the work, the material to be worked on, was something which is found everywhere and universally regarded as valueless. Some adepts maintained that the subject of the work was the same as the apparatus in which it was carried on, the philosopher's egg, or egg-shaped vessel from which the stone would be hatched like a chick. Some helpfully suggested that the work should begin with spittle of the moon, or semen of the stars, or mucus of the stars. Others recommended vitriol, but by vitriol they evidently meant something else, as they expanded the word by notaricon into visita interiora terrae rectificando in venies occultum lapidem. Visit the interior of the earth, and by purifying you will find the secret stone. An alchemist who did not understand these instructions would have to proceed by trial and error. He might begin with a base metal or an alloy, but many other materials were tried. In his Ordinal of Alchemy, the English 15th century adept Thomas Norton of Bristol sneered at those who experimented with grass, roots and herbs, various gums, vervain, mandrake, arsenic, antimony, honey, wax, wine, hair, eggs, dung, urine, and vitriol, all without success. The work might begin with gold itself, or gold would be added at some point in the operations, because it was said that whoever wishes to make gold must have gold to begin with. From a spiritual point of view, it seems clear that the subject of the work was the alchemist himself. Ars totum requirit hominem. The art requires the whole man. The alchemist was both the vessel of the work and the material in it. The valueless thing found everywhere is matter, which in man means the body and the animal nature that is closely linked with it. In matter there is concealed the spirit or divine spark, the moon spittle or star semen or star mucus, which is something fallen from heaven, or the vitriol found in the interior of one's own being. Whoever wants to make gold must begin with gold, because a man cannot find truth unless he is true himself, or God unless he has God within him. A common symbol of the work was a snake or dragon forming a circle by swallowing its own tail and bearing the Greek motto en to pan, all is one. This motto has three words and seven letters, and 3 plus 7 equals 10, which stands for all things, and reduces to one unity. The stone is the one, which is also the all. In human terms, it is the whole man who, in becoming the one, becomes identical with the all, the universe, and God. The work is circular, like the year and the cycle of nature. It begins with the whole man, body, soul, and spirit, and ends with a perfected whole man. Petrus Bonus, author of The New Pearl of Great Price, written about 1330, said that the old philosophers knew, quote, that God would become man on the last day of this art when the work is accomplished. Now, since no creature except man can unite with God, on account of their dissimilarity, God must needs become one with man. And this came to pass in Christ Jesus and his Virgin Mother, unquote. Many alchemists identified the stone with Christ, who was both God and man, but their Christianity was decidedly unorthodox. The work is to be completed while still in the body. The stone is the divine being that each man can crucify and resurrect in himself to attain a kingdom of heaven on earth. The work seems to have proceeded along parallel chemical and mystical lines. The masters of the art said that the alchemist could not succeed except by the grace of God and by prayer and austere devotion to the task. Concentration and imagination were also vital to success. The operations were slow and taxing, and the alchemist might have to repeat one process hundreds of times before it was completed. He was told to read all the authorities on the subject, however mutually contradictory they might be, and struggle to understand them. In the course of this long toil, it was evidently expected that the chemical development of the material in the vessel would be accompanied by a corresponding spiritual development in the alchemist. And when at last the final illumination came, and the secret dawned in all its splendor on his mind, he would find that the work was not difficult at all, and would scarcely be able to understand how he had been so blind before. Some of the later alchemists abandoned laboratory work altogether and said it was unnecessary. But the neophyte had still to go through the same long labor of discovering what the work really meant, the same perplexities, false starts, and misleading sidetracks, the same gradual growth of understanding. Knowledge, in fact, was the key to the stone. When the alchemist understood what the stone was, he had found it and had become it. In alchemy, as in all occultism, the truth is veiled behind symbols and paradoxes, because it has to be discovered for oneself. The occult arts are arts. Their ultimate secrets can be learned, but cannot be taught. Once the beginner had picked a raw material, he faced the difficulty of finding out what operations to perform on it. This was again a matter of lengthy trial and error. It was rare for the experts to agree on exactly what processes were needed to make the stone, or in what order they should be carried out. The early authorities generally said that there were four main stages in the work, distinguished by the appearance of four colors, black, white, yellow, and red, in the material in the vessel. This sequence of color changes appears in the oldest known book on alchemy, Physica Chi Mystica, The Physical and the Mystical, written by Bolus of Mendes in Egypt about 200 BC. It is probably connected with the four elements, and the numerological significance of four as the number which governs the form and construction of things, including the making of gold. By the late Middle Ages, the number of stages had been reduced to three, black, white, and red, reflecting the trinity of mercury, sulfur, and salt, and the significance of three as the number of creation, including the creation of gold. But these were only the main stages, and the details of the work varied from one authority to another. Some alchemists said there were seven processes in the work, others said there were 12. The seven processes corresponded to the 7 days of creation, and also to the seven planets, because the influence of each planet was supposed to generate its own metal in the earth. The metals varied in degree of perfection from lead, the most impure, up to gold. The alchemist began with his raw material in its most impure leaden state, and gradually improved it till it had become the perfect gold, the steps in the work corresponding to the soul's ascent through the planetary spheres. This is one reason why Saturn, the ruler of lead, corresponds to the world in the tarot, the card which marks the beginning of the Kabbalist's upward progress. The 12 processes were connected with the signs of the zodiac. The work was intended to copy the processes of nature, and the 12 months or zodiac signs make up the complete cycle of the year in which nature moves from birth to growth to decay, death, and rebirth. The English alchemist George Ripley gave a list of 12 processes in his Compound of Alchemy, written in 1470, and a very similar list was provided by another adept, Josephus Quercetanus, in 1576. The processes are calcination, solution, separation, conjunction, putrefaction, coagulation, sibation, sublimation, fermentation, exaltation, multiplication, and projection. Any interpretation of these processes, chemical or psychological, is necessarily conjectural. But the first steps, as far as putrefaction, were apparently supposed to purify the raw material and strip its characteristics from it, reducing it to first matter, and releasing its spirit or spark of life. Calcination meant heating the base metal or other raw material of the work in air until it was reduced to a fine powder or ash. Ripley said that this required a moderate heat kept up for a year, which records an earlier Arab alchemist's enthusiastic comment, "Calcination is the treasure of a thing, be not weary of calcination." In destroying the outward form of the base metal, calcination was thought to remove all its surface qualities. Spiritually, calcination probably stands for the purging fires of aspiration and self-discipline, symbolized in the tarot by the Day of Judgment. The work begins with a burning discontent with oneself and one's life, a passionate longing for higher things. It is a process of self-watching and self-judgment, in which a man is constantly weighing himself and finding himself wanting. Combined with a fierce determination to do better, the result is the disintegration of the natural self. The outer, surface aspects of the personality are burned away, and what is left is the powder of the inner man. The second step, solution, was to dissolve the calcined powder in a mineral water which shall not wet the hands. This mineral water was mercury, and some alchemists may have added ordinary mercury at this point, but more often, apparently, the vapors given off during calcination, which were identified as philosopher's mercury, were condensed into the mercurial liquid in which the powder was dissolved. Many alchemists complained of the difficulties of this process. Reducing the raw material to a watery state was usually considered an essential early step in the work. Perform no operation till all be made water. There was a widespread belief that all things originally derived from water, and there was also, more specifically, the authority of Plato and Aristotle for thinking that metals are formed by the congealing of water in the earth. In the Timaeus, Plato classifies as water everything that can exist as a flowing liquid, including metals which flow when they are heated. Gold is water of a fusible kind, and copper is a shining and solid kind of water. Aristotle said that there are two types of exhalation or breath which rise up from the earth when it is heated by the sun. One is more vaporous and moist, the other more smoky and dry. When these exhalations are trapped inside the earth, they turn into metals and minerals. Metals are all produced by the enclosure of the vaporous, moist exhalation, particularly within stones, whose drying compresses it together and solidifies it. The metals are in a sense water, and in another sense not. It was possible for their material to turn into water, but it can no longer do so. Each metal is the result of the solidification of the exhalation before it turns to water. Since in alchemical theory, metals are congealed water, to reduce a metal to water is to get back towards its first matter, and to purify the metal by freeing it from the defects of its growth in earth. It is like the attempts made by some psychoanalysts to put a patient back into his early childhood, and some even pursue him into the womb, also an alchemical motif, to deal with the origins of his psychological defects. Solution, which roughly corresponds to the moon in the tarot, is a process of deep self-examination and self-disgust. The calcined powder, which stands for the more enduring characteristics beneath a man's surface, is dissolved in mercurial water. The alchemist's underlying attitudes, prejudices, tastes, deep-rooted patterns of feeling and reaction are dissolved away through the action of mercury, intelligent insight into himself. The difficulty of the process was to find the true philosophical mercury, the true insight, and it carries the danger of mental collapse, fear, despair, illusion, and self-deception. The water of solution, the alchemist said, is a bitter water, and C.G. Jung, drawing a parallel between alchemy and psychoanalysis, says, quote, "It is bitter indeed to discover behind one's lofty ideals, narrow, fanatical convictions, all the more cherished for that, and behind one's heroic pretensions, nothing but crude egotism, infantile greed, and complacency. This painful corrective is an unavoidable stage in every therapeutic process." Unquote. The ordeal of bitter water leads to the stage of separation. According to Ripley, this drew forth oil and water. It was not done by the operator, but by God, which suggests that the alchemist left the watery material in the vessel alone to separate by itself. The intention was to separate the raw material's original components. These components might be the four elements, or, in the earlier medieval theory, mercury and sulfur. Between them, mercury and sulfur combined the four primary qualities on which the elements themselves were based. Sulfur was hot and dry, corresponding to Aristotle's smoky and dry exhalation, and mercury was cold and wet, the vaporous and moist exhalation. The inflammable sulfur embodied the element fire, hot and dry, the liquid mercury, the element water, cold and wet. Hence, the statement that the stone is made of fire and water. In later alchemy, separation was meant to divide the raw material into mercury, sulfur, and salt, or spirit, soul, and body. Whether separation produced two, three, or four components, its purpose was to purify the material still further and move one stage nearer to first matter by getting back to the basic ingredients. The alchemist originally felt a sense of wholeness in himself, and the work began with this, as it will end in the perfected wholeness of the stone. His examination of the sour wellsprings of his own behavior destroys the sense of wholeness, and he feels as if he were being cut in pieces or torn apart on a rack. T.E. Lawrence described the sensation in Seven Pillars of Wisdom. It was the result of self-loathing combined with physical exhaustion, and in this particular case, interestingly enough, followed subjection to a sadistic sexual discipline, the falling tower and the turret. He found himself dividing into parts. His body, which an alchemist would call salt, continued efficiently about its business, riding a camel. A second part of himself, mercury, hovering above and to the right, bent down and curiously asked what the flesh was doing, while a third part, sulfur, talked and wondered, critical of the body's self-inflicted labor and contemptuous of the reason for effort. The two separated parts carried on a debate about the sense or stupidity of what the body was doing. Lawrence seems to have experienced a separation of opposites, the warring tendencies in himself. He called his condition a death sleep. His Arab companion had to strike him to awaken him from it, and in some accounts of the alchemical work, separation is immediately followed by the stage of death. Ripley and many other alchemists, however, follow separation with conjunction, the achievement of a balance between the warring opposites and their reconciliation. Sulfur and mercury are reunited. This was usually depicted as a marriage or copulation, and frequently as incest between mother and son or brother and sister, because the sulfur and mercury came from the same original raw material. Sulfur, the soul or passionate nature, was incestuously united with mercury, the spirit or dispassionate intellect. This attempt to end the intolerable separation, to find an inner balance, to come to peaceful terms with oneself, was also symbolized as a re-entry into the womb. The sun or the king or the dragon, the material of the work, creeps back into the body of his mother. It is an escape from pressures, not merely the pressures of the bustling world outside, but also those of one's own spiritual condition. The alchemist has been purged of the characteristics and attitudes which are the defects of his growth. The opposing tendencies, which are the basic components of his nature, have been separated, balanced, and put together again. He is the child in the womb, his original self. Conjunction could also be seen as the reunification of the four elements, or the recombining of mercury, sulfur, and salt. It required steady and moderate heating, a hard thing for the alchemist to achieve. He had no way of gauging the temperature in his furnace accurately, and it was difficult for him to keep up a level heat. The alchemist had now reached the first form of his material before it had acquired imperfections through the accidents of nature. It consisted of first matter and an animating spark of life. The next step was to kill the material and release its life spark, which was done by subjecting it to a moist heat, by warming the alchemical vessel in a water bath, for instance, or in fermenting dung. The material lying at the bottom of the vessel should gradually turn black, a sign that it had become first matter, a dead, featureless mass from which all characteristics had been removed, including color, black being regarded as the absence of color. The material was believed to be rotting, and the process was called putrefaction. Vapor, the life spark, or spirit, or philosopher's mercury, was given off, and the alchemist noted that putrefaction was accompanied by a foul smell, the grave stench. The first main stage of the work, the Negrito, or black stage, was called the Black Crow, Crow's Head, Raven's Head, or Black Sun, and was symbolized by a dead and rotting corpse, or a black bird, a black man, a king slaughtered by warriors, or a dead king eaten by a wolf. Different adepts led up to the Negrito in different ways. One simple method was to heat copper with sulfur, which would turn it into a black mass of copper sulfide, first matter. Black and stinking as it was, the putrefying first matter was potentially the marvelous stone, and the alchemists took the words of the Song of Solomon as a reference to it. I am black but comely, O ye daughters of Jerusalem. It was essential for the material to rot because putrefaction was thought to be a necessary precondition of life. Seed which fell to earth was believed to die and rot, releasing the life principle which caused new growth, shown in death in the tarot. In classical times and in the Middle Ages, it was accepted that frogs were generated from rotting mud, bees and other insects from the mouldering corpses of animals, wasps from dead asses, beetles from horses, locusts from mules. In a wider sense, the essential preliminary to rebirth was death, real or symbolic. The alchemists could quote St. Paul, "Thou fool, that which thou sowest is not quickened except it die," and "So also is the resurrection of the dead. It is sown in corruption. It is raised in incorruption. It is sown a natural body. It is raised a spiritual body." They also had the authority of Jesus. "Except a corn of wheat fall into the ground and die, it abideth alone. But if it die, it bringeth forth much fruit." With its spiritual corollary in the next verse, "He that loveth his life shall lose it, and he that hateth his life in this world shall keep it unto life eternal." The Negrito is the mock death of the mystery initiations. This is a primitive idea. Among the Australian Aborigines, for instance, a magician's initiation involved a sleep of death and rebirth. The alchemist is in the womb, fully turned in on himself, and he undergoes the mystical death identified by the adepts with melancholy, a state of helpless dejection and spiritual rot in which the spirit or spark of life abandons the body and soul, the hanged man. The original self, or first matter, dies in the black agony of Negrito. A parallel was often drawn between the Negrito and the crucifixion, from which the God-man rose to eternal life. The death was a crucifixion in the sense of a suspension in suffering. It was symbolized by a snake nailed to a cross. And as Moses lifted up the serpent in the wilderness, even so must the Son of Man be lifted up. The alchemist is now dead, putrefying in the slime of melancholy, but slowly a healing illumination comes with the gentle descent of philosophical mercury, true inspiration, the divine spark. The vapor given off during putrefaction hovers over the black material in the vessel, like the Holy Spirit moving upon the dark waters of Genesis. It penetrates the first matter, animates it, and creates the embryo which will grow into the stone. The process is described in an alchemical version of the Mass written by Nicholas Melchior, who was astrologer to the King of Hungary in the early 16th century. The parallel between the work of alchemy and the transformation of bread and wine into the body and blood of Christ in the Mass was drawn by many alchemists. "Then will appear in the bottom of the vessel the mighty Ethiopian, burned, calcined, bleached, altogether dead and lifeless." The Ethiopian is the black first matter. "He asks to be buried, to be sprinkled with his own moisture, and slowly calcined till he shall arise in glowing form from the fierce fire. Behold, a wondrous restoration or renewal of the Ethiopian." Evidently, the vapor or spirit was condensed into a liquid which saturated the first matter while the vessel was heated. This was the alchemical bath of rebirth, and the alchemists saw the process as the rebirth through water and the spirit. "Except a man be born again, he cannot see the kingdom of God. Except a man be born of water and of the Spirit, he cannot enter into the kingdom of God. When the Spirit and the first matter had been rejoined, a white solid crystallized from the watery material in the vessel. This was the process of coagulation or congelation, corresponding to the appearance of dry land out of the waters on the third day of creation. The elements of the stone flow together, Ripley says. The white solid is the white stone, or white tincture, which turns all things to silver. The appearance of the white stone marked the second main stage of the work, the albedo, or whitening, and the alchemists connected it with the white stone of Revelation 2:17. To him that overcometh will I give to eat of the hidden manna, and will give him a white stone, and in the stone a new name written, which no man knoweth, saving him that receiveth it. In spite of the constantly repeated maxim, nihil extraneum, nothing from outside, some alchemists were not above assisting the production of the white stone by adding new ingredients at this point. A little silver might be added with mercury, arsenic, antimony, or tin, which would whiten the surface of the material in the vessel. Another method is given in the medieval Allegoria Merlini, which describes the work under the cover of a story about a king, the raw material, who drank so much water that his limbs were filled with it, solution, and he felt as if he was falling to pieces, separation. His doctors put him in a heated chamber, and when they took him out, he was dead, Negredo. The doctors took the body, ground it to powder, washed it, and dried it. They added to it one part rock salt, two parts saltpeter, and a little linseed oil to make a paste. They put the paste into a crucible in which holes had been bored, and placed another crucible underneath. Then they heated and melted the paste so that the liquid ran down into the lower crucible, upon which the king rose up, resurrected. The white stone is a new self, a new earth appearing out of the waters, peace, innocence, happiness, freedom from conflict. Silver is the metal of the moon, and the white stone shines in the alchemist's being like the moon in the night sky, turning the darkness to silver. From this point, the third and final stage of the work leads to the rubido, the red dawn which heralds the coming of the sun in splendor, the dazzling light of a new day. The next step is sibation, in which the material in the vessel is fed with milk and meat moderately. This nourishes the embryonic stone, corresponding to the feeding of a baby, and may mean that fresh material was added to the vessel, though it is not clear what. Gerhard Dorn, a pupil of Paracelsus, recommended the addition of various ingredients in the later stages of the work, including human blood, celandine, and honey. The blood would infuse life energy into the stone. Celandine would give joy and good spirits, because it was supposed to be a cure for night blindness, and by extension, for melancholy, the night of gloom. Honey stood for the sweetness of life and was also a preservative. It was the only sweetening substance in use until comparatively modern times, and was used in antiquity to embalm dead bodies because it prevents putrefaction. Dorn said that the honey or sweetness of life might change into a deadly poison, and celandine, which gives clear sight, was perhaps an antidote to it. In the remaining processes, from sublimation to projection, it is easier to take the chemical and psychological steps separately. The alchemist now adds to his growing stone the qualities which it must have when completed, perfect purity and stability, the ability to convert base metals to gold, and the ability to convert far more than its own weight in base metals. Sublimation was a purification. The solid material in the vessel was heated until it vaporized, and the vapor then rapidly cooled and condensed back into the solid state. This was repeated several times, and was often symbolized by doves, swans, or other birds flying up to heaven and descending again. The purpose was to rid the stone's body of the original filth which accompanied its birth through putrefaction. The body was purged by converting it into vapor or spirit and discarding the residue, and the spirit was then reconverted into body. As a stage in the growth of the stone, the solidification of the vapor recalls Aristotle's exhalations, solidified in the earth and becoming metals and minerals. In the next step, fermentation, the material in the vessel turns yellow and becomes gold. Many alchemists said that gold should be added at this point to hasten the stone's natural development into gold. Although it is not yet quite perfected, the stone now acquires the ability to transmute base metals. It becomes a ferment or leaven, able to permeate, agitate, and spur on the development of a base metal in the same way that yeast permeates dough and makes it rise. This quality comes from the stone's soul, or sulfur, the fiery driving component which excites and enlivens the base metal. And in fermentation, the stone's soul is united with its already purified body. Petrus Bonus explained that the stone cannot change and color other metals until it has been changed and colored itself. Quote, "And so our stone is rendered capable of fermenting, converting and altering metals by means of a certain digestive heat, which brings out its potential and latent properties when the artist sees the white soul arise," unquote. Exaltation brings the last color change of the work, the rubido or reddening. The alchemists evidently found that in the later stages of the work, the material in the vessel was highly unstable. In exaltation, all the stone's components were fused in unalterable harmony and unity. The body and soul, combined in fermentation, were now united with the spirit, and the stone became fixed and enduring. The heat of the furnace was raised to its highest intensity, and the excited alchemist saw the marvelous spectacle for which he had labored so long, the appearance of the true stone of the philosophers itself, the perfect red gold, the red tincture, or red elixir, the One. On the fifth day of creation, when God had made every living thing that moves except man, he commanded them, "Be fruitful and multiply," and the same command was later given to Adam and Eve. The stone needed one more quality, already latent within it, the ability to be fruitful and multiply itself by transmuting quantities of base metal far in excess of its own size and weight. This was produced through the process called multiplication or augmentation. The stone was made fertile and fruitful in another conjunction or copulation or union of opposites, the royal marriage of soul and spirit, sulfur and mercury, king and queen, sun and moon, the red man and the white woman, standing for all the opposites which are reconciled in the One. In the 12th and last process, projection, the stone was applied to a base metal to convert it to gold. This was usually done by wrapping a piece of it in wax or paper and heating it with the base metal in a crucible. These final processes involve repeated balancing and combination of the stone's components or opposites. The alchemists were necessarily concerned to achieve a proper balance of opposites so as to reconcile them. The Book of Mercury, by the famous Arab alchemist Geber, or one of his followers, explains that in some cases the opposites are inextricably mixed together and cannot be balanced. Quote, "No more will you find spirit which does not contain a little body, nor body which does not contain a little spirit. Sometimes these two elements cannot be separated when one of them is too abundant and the other too much lacking, so that there is a transformation and absorption of the part which is less in quantity by the part that predominates." Unquote. In human terms, this means that those who are over-spiritual at the expense of the body and those who are over-physical at the expense of the soul are both far from perfection. The whole man is the balanced man. In psychoanalysis, Jung says, the problem of opposites, quote, "is the disassociation of the personality brought about by the conflict of incompatible tendencies resulting, as a rule, from an inharmonious disposition. The repression of one of the opposites leads only to a prolongation and extension of the conflict, in other words, to a neurosis. The therapist, therefore, confronts the opposites with one another and aims at uniting them permanently." Unquote. The same permanent union of opposites is the aim of magic and alchemy, but the alchemical processes involve more complicated considerations. The stone has three components, body, soul, and spirit, which are joined together in four steps. Sublimation unites body and spirit. Fermentation unites the spiritual body with the soul. Exaltation unites body, soul, and spirit. Multiplication unites soul and spirit. This repetitious pattern of unions is connected with the alchemist's attempts to reconcile the numbers 4, 3, and 2 and reduce them to 1. The riddle of the Sphinx was, what has 4 feet in the morning, 2 at midday, and 3 in the evening? Oedipus answered man. But another answer is alchemy, which began with the belief that all things are made of 4 elements, then developed the theory that they are made of 2, mercury and sulfur, and finally the theory that they are made of 3, mercury, sulfur, and salt. The adoption of a new theory did not cause the discarding of an old one. They continue to exist side by side. From the alchemist's point of view, the riddle was, how are 4 turned into 2 and then into 3, which is also 1? The 4 changes into the 2 because the 4 primary qualities of the 4 elements are all contained in the 2 opposites of sulfur, hot and dry, and mercury, cold and wet. But it is not enough to say that all things are made of 2, because 2 is the number of evil, hostility, and unreconciled opposites. All things must be made of 3, which joins the opposites in unity. But this 3 must contain the original 4. The 3 contains the 4 in alchemy because mercury has a double nature. The trinity of mercury, sulfur, and salt conceals a quaternity. Mercury can be seen as single or double as required. Sulfur, mercury, salt, soul, spirit, body, male, male, female, female, fire, air and water, earth. Michael Myers' solution to the Sphinx's riddle, quoted earlier, was, from a man and a woman make a circle, then a square, then a triangle, finally a circle, and you will obtain the Philosopher's Stone. In sublimation, the alchemist takes a man and a woman, mercury, spirit, as male, and salt, body, as female, and joins them together or makes them into a circle. In fermentation, sulfur, soul, is added to make 4, or a square. Salt, 1, plus mercury, 2, plus sulfur, 1. In exaltation, these are regarded as 3, or a triangle, and they are joined or made into a circle, which is the stone, or 1. Modern occultists juggle with the numbers from 1 to 4 in a similar way to produce a law which states that all activities or processes are triangular and at the same time quadrangular. 1 is the active element or power which initiates any process. 2 is the passive element which serves as a fulcrum or basis for 1. 3 is the combination of 1 and 2, the result of the action. But the 3 together make a new unit, which is 4. And 4 is also the active element of a new process, the 1 of the next triangle. This is the modern explanation of the saying of Mary the prophetess, handed down through many generations of alchemists. 1 becomes 2, 2 becomes 3, and out of the third comes the 1 as the fourth. The Tetragrammaton, considered as the real name of God, and therefore as the essence of all things, enshrines the same type of occult and alchemical formula. It has 4 letters, but it also has 3, because 1 letter is repeated. YHVH. Yod, He, Vor, He. The 4 letters are taken to represent the 4 elements, which contain 2 pairs of opposites, hot, cold, and wet, dry. Yod, He, Vor, He. Fire, water, air, earth. Hot and dry, cold and wet, hot and wet, cold and dry. Male, female, male, female. Will, understanding, mind, body. Yod, 1, is the Father, the active principle in God and the universe. He, 2, is the mother, the passive principle. Their union produces a son, Vo, 3, who corresponds to air, the product of the combination of fire and water, and to mind, the product of the combination of will and understanding. Finally, the daughter, He, 4, is produced corresponding to earth and body, the solidification or materialization of the first three. The final He is the daughter and twin sister and bride of Vor, just as Eve was produced from Adam's body, was created by the same father, and was Adam's wife. And Eve's emergence from Adam is the parallel to the emanation of God's thought from God. Vor, mind, is the king's son who rescues the enchanted princess. He, final, body, and marries her. The effect of this is to place her on the throne of her mother, the first He, understanding, and it is her youthful embrace which reawakens Yod, will, the All-Father, so that the process begins all over again. This family relationship symbolizes the whole course of the universe. The course of the universe, in fact, is cyclical, the snake devouring its own tail, and the great work is a circle. The Tetragrammaton has four letters, which are two pairs of opposites, but the four are also three, and the name runs in a circle to make one, since it is the essence of God who is the One. There is a sharp contrast between this system and the more conventional view that perfection is attained by shedding the body and animal nature altogether as vicious and earthbound. Here, body is joined with mind to become understanding, whose union with will completes the cycle and begins a new one. The occultist, as Dian Fortune said, does not try to escape from matter into spirit, leaving an unconquered country behind him to get on as best it may. In alchemy, the processes of sublimation, fermentation, and exaltation correspond to the union of body and mind and their elevation to the throne of understanding. In sublimation, body is vaporized into spirit, and spirit in turn condensed into body, so that the two are joined in a spiritual body. The original filth purged from the body was sometimes said to be outward sulfur. Some alchemists maintain that all things contain two sulfurs, inward and outward. The outward sulfur is stinking and impure dross, which must be removed, but the pure inward sulfur is essential to the making of the stone. For the more orthodox Christian alchemists, outward sulfur probably meant the love of self, and inward sulfur, the love of God. But some alchemists and the modern Kabbalists do not take them in quite this sense. Sulfur stands for desires, feelings, motives. Inward sulfur means inner motives, the real will, beloved of Hegelian philosophers and modern occultists. Outward sulfur means superficial desires and interests. The removal of outward sulfur in sublimation spiritualizes the body by freeing it from surface worldly motives and concerns. The alchemist is now left open to the free play of his inner driving forces. In fermentation, the spiritual body is united with the soul. The fiery principle of inward sulfur, the soul or real will, works in the spiritual body as a ferment or leaven, changing and coloring the personality and transforming it to gold. The process is one of intoxicated surrender to one's true inner self, a seething emotional disturbance and excitement which becomes an ecstasy, strength in the turret. Modern occultists call the ferment the life in the juice of the grape and the presence of Bacchus. Crowley hails Bacchus as man-woman, both divine and human, drunk on delight of the godly grape, thou knowest no more the burden of the body and the vexation of the spirit. The magician's ordinary self is, quote, a mob of wild women, hysterical from uncomprehended and unsated animal instinct. They will tear Penthus, the merely human king who presumes to repress them, into mere shreds of flesh, unquote. It is Bacchus, the true self, who will, quote, transform the disorderly rabble into a pageant of harmonious movements,
tune their hyena howls to the symphony of a paean, and their reasonless rage to self-controlled rapture. Unquote. Bacchus is doubly double, a god and an animal, a woman and a man. He is the true self, the human equivalent of God or Tetragrammaton, whose four letters are two pairs of opposites, and fermentation was thought to unite four components, mercury being double. Besides this, some of the alchemists said that mercury and sulfur are two pairs of opposites, not one. Mercury is outwardly mercury, but inwardly sulfur, and sulfur is outwardly sulfur, but inwardly mercury. In other words, everything contains its own contradiction, and whatever combines mercury and sulfur unites two pairs of opposites and is doubly double. The Bacchic frenzy of fermentation leads directly to exaltation, in which man becomes the stone. The alchemist said that the material in the vessel was unstable, which suggests that the excitement of fermentation too often dwindled and broke down with no lasting result. Exaltation was achieved only if the heat of the furnace could be raised to a sufficient pitch of intensity, only if the ecstasy could be carried to the highest peak of self-controlled rapture. Then the stone glowed brilliant red in all its glory in the vessel, and the alchemist attained the ecstatic union with the divine. Body, soul, and spirit were fused in the perfect and everlasting harmony of the whole man. Exaltation corresponds to the chariot in the tarot, and the charioteer has solved the riddle of the Sphinx. The four, the three, and the two have become one. When man becomes the stone, or the one, he becomes one with the universe. The process is a kind of death, and the alchemist has achieved the full magical significance of the words quoted earlier, "Except a corn of wheat fall into the ground and die, it abideth alone. But if it die, it bringeth forth much fruit." The last two processes, multiplication and projection, are necessary because the work is cyclical. God is first one, then two as a pair of opposites, and then through the union of the opposites, three, the creator, from which follows four, the creation of the physical universe. To halt the work with the stone as one in exaltation would be to cut the universe's lifeline. The human spirit, which soars to union with the universe, must become part of its unceasing process. Love, in both multiplication and projection, is the completion of the work and its new beginning. Love, Eliphas Levi said, quote, is one of the mythological images of the great secret and the great agent, because it at once expresses an action and a passion, a void and a plenitude, a shaft and a wound, unquote. In the royal marriage of multiplication, the one becomes two, and the two are united, the union of Yod and He in Tetragrammaton, the lovers in the tarot. The wedding of sulfur and mercury stands for the fruitful union of all the opposites which are contained in the stone. From the union of the two comes the fecundating power of the third. In projection, the Pope in the tarot, the stone is mingled with a base metal, which is the alchemical parallel to the action of the Holy Spirit projected upon the waters in Genesis, animating first matter and creating the phenomena of the universe with which the alchemist began. The work has come full circle. For some adepts, at least, the last stages of the work were connected with the astral body, for which they saw a warrant in St. Paul's distinction between the natural and spiritual bodies. It is sown a natural body, it is raised a spiritual body. Within the human body, Gerhard Dorn said, quote, there is hidden a certain metaphysical substance known only to the very few, whose essence it is to need no medicament, for it is itself uncorrupted medicament. And there is in natural things a certain truth which cannot be seen with the outward eye, but is perceived by the mind alone. The philosophers have known it, and they have found that its power is so great as to work miracles. In this lies the whole art of freeing the spirit from its fetters, and it is the highest power and an impregnable fortress wherein the philosopher's stone lies guarded. Unquote. Several Renaissance occultists and alchemists mention what is now called the astral body or the astral light, the substance of which the astral body is composed. Dawn's uncorrupted metaphysical substance, or truth, perceived by the mind alone. In his Occult Philosophy, Agrippa says that the human soul gains prophetic power when it transcends its normal bounds and escapes from the body to spread over space like a light escaped from a lantern. The experience comes through continued yearning heavenward from a pure body, the hermit in the tarot, which carries the soul out of the body to pervade all space and all time. According to Paracelsus, man has three bodies corresponding to body, soul, and spirit. The elemental or physical, the sidereal or astral, and the illumined body or spark of God, which recalls the luminous self of the Manichaeans. The astral body comes from the stars and consists of the accretions or layers added to the soul during its descent through the planetary spheres. It exceeds the measures of nature. It can neither be tied nor grasped, and can pass through walls and partitions without breaking anything. The association of the astral with the soul, which stands between the body and the spirit or mind, accounts for the nature of the creatures of the astral plane, which are not like material things and not like mental pictures, but somewhere between the two. The astral plane, in modern theory, is the one in which desires, emotions, and feelings move. It has the same relation to the physical plane as a man's emotions have to his body, and beyond it is the mental plane on which spiritual beings move. Although the creatures of these planes are products of the mind and the imagination, to some extent at least, occultists believe, either they have an independent existence or that for practical purposes it is convenient to assume that they do. Paracelsus said that the physical body is dead, but that the astral body is animated and volatile. The rising of vapor from a heated substance was believed to have its parallel in man, and the production of the spiritual body in sublimation, the repeated transformation of a solid to a vapor, and the vapor's reconversion to a solid, was the production of the ability to enter the astral plane and return to the physical body. The original filth, or outward sulfur, purged away in sublimation, stands for the petty surface motives and interests which tie a man to the physical plane. The increasing heat or frenzy of fermentation and exaltation leads to the point at which the alchemist is finally carried out beyond the bounds of his own being into a lasting union with the universe. He pervades all space and all time. He enters the impregnable fortress in which the stone lies guarded.